Hey, welcome to Campus Alliance, everybody. My name is Chris, lead pastor here at the church. Big kind of virtual hug to you wherever you are. Thanks for trusting us being here this weekend. Matthew chapter 6 is where we're going to be. Two quick things. Number one, the Alakbi family. We've been telling you about them all fall. They're living in Turkey right now. We as a church have decided to sponsor them. So we got news this week that end of November, looks like they're going to be here, which is fantastic. I know, Alakbi family, you are tuning in. So we can't wait to see you guys. Two ways, KAC, that you guys can get involved. First thing is we need to furnish a two-bedroom place for them. So if you have, listen, new or very gently use things for a two-bedroom place for them, call the office. We are looking to furnish that place. Number two, we need to raise some more money. We're looking at about, we need a $50,000. We're just over 31, so we're about $19,000. If you want to help sponsor this family to come, New Canadian Initiative, either online giving or on your offering envelope. So that's the first thing. The second thing you need to know about is I had a few weeks off, and I just want to take an opportunity to cast vision. A few weeks off, why does Chris not preach every week? What is he doing? Well, here's what I'm doing. There's some strategy behind this. Why share the pulpit, Chris? The first thing is development. If I'm up here, that means somebody else can't be. And so we just have a great team here that we want to develop. I am the product of a developing church, the one that I was at before I got here. And so I just want to give that gift to other people. The second thing is diversity. You need to hear other voices. And some of you are like, yeah, we do. Man, he talks too much. So you need to hear other voices. And so we have older people and younger people and men and women. And so you need to hear different voices, not all the time, but you need to hear different voices. It's important. Third thing is health. Health for you in all of these things. Health for our staff. Also health for me. One of the greatest gifts that I can give KAC is a healthy long-term ministry. And so that's what we're doing with this, is that we just want to make sure there's longevity for me. And we're thinking about that for all of our staff. Also health for me to be in the chairs. And last weekend I was able to listen to Pastor Larry talk about gratitude. And I, as a disciple of Jesus, need to sit under the preaching of the word as well. And so that's why, just to cast some vision. Okay, Matthew chapter 6, here we go. We are in a series called The World Anew. Pandemics are the time where everything is put on the table and our world is changing and your world is changing. So we're asking all these questions about who am I? Do I still want to do that job? And maybe I want to retire sooner than I thought, or all of these different things are like at the forefront of our minds. So the question is, how do we live? How do we live? And what we're trying to do is we're trying to listen to Jesus of Nazareth tell us how to live life. What does a flourishing life look like? And so we're paying attention to the Sermon on the Mount. So if you're a follower of Jesus, let's go on the journey. If you're a skeptic or seeking, glad that you're here as we listen again to the sermon that Jesus preached in the Gospel of Matthew. Ray Romano, I'm sure most of you know who he is, but he's a stand-up comedian. He had a sitcom for a long time called Everybody Loves Raymond. In 2019, in Time, the magazine, an interviewer sits down with Ray Romano and starts to ask him about the movie that he just released. Here is a snippet of that interview. The interviewer says, "At one point in the movie, your character waits too long to say, 'I love you.' Why is that phrase so hard to say?" Ray Romano says, "I grew up never hearing it from my father, but it doesn't flow out of my mouth either." That phrase, "I love you," he never heard, and now he doesn't say it himself. He goes on, "My brother and I played on the same softball team, and we had a hard time even high-fiving each other. I always say if my father hugged me once, I'd be an accountant right now." Now, there's probably some comedic value in what he's saying there, but here's the statement. Man, if I knew that my father's love and affection and approval of me, I would do something different than what I am doing right now. What an interesting statement. So the question that we're going to be exploring this weekend is, how would your life change if you knew you were fully loved? Romano says, "I'd be an accountant." That it would change his life. How would your life change if you knew how much you were loved? So what we're going to do is we're going to listen to Jesus in Matthew chapter 6 and the greatest sermon ever told. What we're going to see, in a world of shallow hypocrisy, God's love gives us the strength to live authentic lives. In a world of just shallow, God's love, his approval of us, gives us strength to live authentically ourselves. And so here, let's pay attention. Let's listen to him preaching. Be careful. Matthew 6, verse 1. Jesus says, "Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others, your righteousness. This is an important word. We've talked about this word already in this sermon. Righteousness can be defined as moral action according to God's will. Another way you can understand this is a whole person behavior that accords with God's nature, His will, and His coming kingdom. And so this righteousness is a behavior according to God's three things: nature, will, and coming kingdom. There's a way to live in the world that is righteous and a way to live in the world that is unrighteous. A righteous person is living their lives, a whole body behavior, so mind and heart and soul and hands and feet, all of these sort of things, according to God's will. His will, His decrees, His commandments in Scripture, His nature being good and trustworthy, and His coming kingdom, life in the kingdom. This is the righteousness that He is saying. Be careful not to practice your behavior in accordance with God's nature, will, and kingdom in front of others to be seen by them. This idea of righteousness is all the way through His sermon. That Jesus here is saying, be careful that your outer acts, you don't do them from a bad motivation. So here's what's really important, what Jesus is saying. What Jesus is interested in is, yes, outward acts, but done with an inner purity. And here's the difficulty of Christianity, especially if you're checking this out. Christianity isn't just about the outward behavior modification. What Jesus is saying here, the motivation in which you do those things matters as much or almost more importantly than the act itself. Sometimes we look at Christianity and it's like, oh, this is just an outward thing. It's just all about doing the right things and thinking. No. Jesus is saying here, your righteousness must be done with a pure heart. And this is what makes Christianity so difficult. And then he says, be careful not to practice your righteousness, your behavior according to God's nature, will, and kingdom in front of others to be seen by them. Oh, to be seen by other people. Look at how good I am. See, there is an innate desire for approval. When we do these things, we are kind of looking around. Did anybody notice? And this speaks to the human desire for approval, that we are all searching for approval. Christian history is helpful for us because it introduces this idea I'm about to tell you about. This isn't a specifically biblical idea, but through church history, thinkers, ancients have come up with what they call the seven deadly sins. One of those seven deadly sins is the idea of vain glory. Vain glory. There's a philosopher. Her name is Rebecca DeYoung. She's a Notre Dame PhD-trained philosopher. She's a philosopher at Calvin College. She wrote a great book, an amazing book on the seven deadly sins called Glittering Vices. And Rebecca DeYoung helps us here when she defines vainglory as the excessive and disordered desire. Interesting words, disordered desire for recognition and approval from others. Listen, that we all have an excessive, it's more than what it should, disordered, it's priority one, what it should be, priority 10, desire for what? Two things, recognition and approval. As Ray Romano says, if my father hugged me once, I'd be an accountant right now. That this is all of us. All of us struggle with an excessive and disordered desire for recognition and approval from others. So regardless of how you're showing up this weekend, follower of Jesus, you're in, you love Jesus, you follow Him, all that's great. But some of you are maybe skeptics or seekers and you're checking us out. Here is the reality of the human condition. All of us are guilty of this. And the question is, why? How did we all become like this? Well, Christianity helps us. Christianity gives us what's called a meta-narrative. It gives us this idea of how did humanity become like this? And so what we do is we go look to the Bible. And the Bible gives us an origin narrative, a creation story in the book of Genesis. And the book of Genesis starts out with Adam and Eve made in the image of God, in relationship with God, fully at home and fully present with themselves and each other and with the God who made them. And there is a fracture that happens in Genesis chapter 3, where Adam and Eve turn their back on God and say, we can do it better ourselves. We can be the architect of a better life. What they do when they turn their back to God is they actually fracture this relationship, where they were once at home and settled and living in the delight and love that God has for them. When they turn their back, a fracture happens in their soul, and now they live unsettled and insecure without the relationship that they had with God Almighty, the creator of their souls. They are now insecure and unsettled. And that happened in the past, and it is true of us today, that we have all inherited this little fracture in our souls, that we are disconnected from the God who made us. That is the Christian understanding of how we got here. So, how does this play out? Well, because we are all unsettled and insecure, we exaggerate to impress. We tell lies that the fish we caught was actually only 8 pounds, but we say to everybody it was 15 pounds. We want to ensure that people see our good acts, that we walk around, hey, look at how good I am, and we look at how put together my family is, and look at how scrubbed up my Instagram feed is. That we do something because we are unsettled and insecure. We do things that are wrong just to be accepted by other people. And this happens all the time on high school campuses, on Friday night at Friday night parties, that there is this kind of this moral compass that gets abandoned when we're with our friends. Why? Because we want to be seen by them to be normal, and their approval means so much that we actually abandon our moral compass to be approved. For some of us, it presents itself by having performance anxiety because we're so wrapped around the axle of our job that we can't actually self-differentiate from our job. And so our job performance reviews tells us exactly who we are. And if that drops, man, we're wrecked. So some of us, this represents or presents itself because we spend too much on things to impress others. That your budget is here, but you actually spend this much just so that your family or your friends think that you are successful and you have it all together. And what a nice car, or what a nice toy, or what a nice house. And so we spend too much on these things because of our addiction to vainglory. For some of us, it presents this way, that we don't actually have people in our houses because we are represented and identified by our houses. So we don't want to host people because they will think a certain way about us. Why? Because we have an excessive and disordered desire for recognition and approval from others. For others of us, our physical appearance determines where we go or where we don't go. Well, I can't go like that. My hair isn't done. Or I can't go, and I'm a mess. What is that? It's an excessive and disordered desire for recognition and approval from others instead of living in the Father's love, instead of living whole and settled and at home in your relationship with God. We have vain glory. And it's true, I think of you, and it's true of me. It's absolutely true of me. In grade 6, I moved from Burnaby to Kelowna. It was a grade 6. I kind of wanted to fit in as a new friend group and new kid at school. I moved like halfway through the year. So, man, it was just so hard. So what I want to do is I want to kind of be cool. I want to be the cool kid. And so I remember wanting to have like kind of like the surfer blonde-tipped hair, except my surfer blonde-tipped hair turned into like burnt orange hair. And I had glasses on, and everybody was growing this way, but I was growing this way. And it was a rough part of, awkward part of my life. So I landed at this new school, and what was cool in Kelowna at the time is snowboarding. So to get in, I just told everybody, yeah, I snowboard. I'm a good snowboarder. So I bought snowboarding magazines, and I plastered my binders with snowboarders, and I kind of got all the information about snowboarding. I told people that I could do a 540 rotation off a jump. But the problem is that I had never been on a snowboard in my entire life. Why did I make all that up? Because I wanted recognition and approval and acceptance from other people. I didn't think that I was enough. I didn't think Chris Thronis was enough. And so I made up a story to try to fit in. Well, fast forward to high school. My appearance changed. I had really long, dark black, dyed black hair and earrings in my ears and studded belts and skulls and skateboards. And I look back and it's like, man, I mean, it was a great time. I went to all these punk rock shows and I was kind of that kid. Looking back, I was independent enough to be like everybody else, and I just wanted to fit in. I wanted people's approval. Fast forward to a few years ago. Right, I'm blogging online and trying to do this thing with a bunch of my friends. We launch a website, we're blogging, and it's a Christian blog, and I'm a pastor, and instead of just doing it for its own sake, I post a blog and I just hit refresh to see how many people want it. Why? Because I wanted recognition and approval from other people. It's true of today. As I'm standing here in this empty sanctuary, and I, back of my mind sometimes going, I hope people like this, and I hope people don't think I look dumb, and all of these things, that vainglory, excessive, and disordered desire for recognition and approval, it's true of me, and if you're courageous enough, I believe it's also true of you. Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen, the purpose to be seen by them, Jesus is saying to us. Nowhere is this most clearly pronounced or seen in our culture than social media. Why? Because social media makes you the spotlight. Literally, we are on the stage of our lives, lights, camera, action, Instagram storying, Facebook storying, TikToking, dancing on TikTok, whatever it is. And what do? How many people liked it? How many people commented it? How many influencers, how many people can you influence? The idea of a social media influencer right now is about how many people can like you. So here we are. Here we are. We are like politicians, walking around looking at everybody else for our approval ratings. 2015, there's a model. Her name is Asena O'Neill. She's from Australia. She had 500,000 followers on Instagram. Beautiful. She's a model. The outward look into her life was, man, she's got it made. What else does she want? 500,000 followers, influence, all that. But inwardly, she was a mess, anxiety, loneliness, depression. So 2015, she snapped. She couldn't handle it anymore. And she went to the most liked photos that she had on her Instagram feed, the ones with the most likes, and she recaptioned all of them to tell people what was actually happening. And here is one of them. On one of her photos, she recaptioned it to say, please like this photo. I put on makeup, curled my hair, tight dress, big uncomfortable jewelry, took over 50 shots until I got the one I thought you might like. Then I edited this one selfie for ages on several apps just so I could feel some social approval from you. Vainglory. There is nothing real about this. Hashtag celebrity construct. See what she's saying? She is recognizing the thing that you and I deal with every day. And if we're honest, some of it, not all of it, maybe it's not true of you, but some of it is because of vainglory and excessive and disordered desire for recognition and approval from others. And listen to the words of Jesus again. Listen, be careful not to practice your good behavior in front of others to be seen by them. Why? If you do, you will have no reward, absolutely no reward from your Father in heaven. This idea of reward kind of links these four verses that we're going to link, that we're going to talk about. So these types of people, there's no reward. It goes on in Matthew chapter 6, verse 2. Here's an option now. So when you give to the needy, this is what Jesus is saying. When you give to the needy, this righteousness now, he's going to spell out in three different ways. The first one is giving, or almsgiving. Second one is prayer. And the third one is fasting. And so that's what really sets us up here for the next 20 or so verses on the Sermon on the Mount. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets. So here's what's going on. There's streets, there's trumpets, there's synagogues. Here's what was going on in the first century. The hypocrites that Jesus is talking about are the Pharisees. Their righteousness was morally spick and span and pure. They in the streets of Jerusalem. would have trumpets to have, hey, we're doing a giving campaign. Would everybody come and look at how great we are? Because back then, they didn't have the social programs that we have now. Welfare didn't exist. So the ones on the margins socioeconomically were taken care of by the common folk. So this is what Jesus is saying. Do you not announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogues? To be honored by them. The option, here's the first option, is to be hypocritical in our giving, in our alms, in our charity. And the way that he describes these people is the word hypocrites. Hypocrites. This is about acting. Literally in the original language, it's gonna give the idea of somebody with a mask on a stage. Presenting not their true self, but their false self. The self that wants to be recognized, honored by others. That's the self that they really are interested in. There's not pure motivation behind their giving. They are hypocrites. See, these hypocrites, what they do is they take something that is good, charity and generosity, and with an evil intent and an evil motivation, they pervert it. This shows us that a good can be taken too far if not given in the right way. This is the self that we want people to see, but it is not our true selves. It's false. It's false. Hypocrisy. Living on a stage, wanting people to see you in a certain way, is the result of a heart that is set out because of vainglory. Because our excessive and disordered desires for recognition and approval from others makes us put on a false self in front of others. We become hypocritical. That instead of being at home and settled in the love of God, we sell out to others by presenting a self that isn't true. So, Jesus then talks again about this reward. This reward. He says, truly I tell you, they have received their reward in full. This word received in the original language is the same type of word that you would have in like a commercial exchange. I am the seller, you were the buyer. The buyer comes in. This whatever I'm selling is $15. They give me $15. I have received my reward in full. I'm not getting anything more than what they have paid me. The exchange is over. That's what he's saying. They've received their reward in full. Here's the thing. Here's what Jesus is saying. He is saying that vainglory works. Sounds scary. Vainglory works. Temporarily, it absolutely works. It doesn't take much to lie or exaggerate. It doesn't take much to convince the banks to give you a little extra money to buy something that you can't afford so that others will be impressed. It doesn't take much to get a following on Instagram. You can buy them if you want. Vainglory works. Impressive people impress. That's what he's saying. But that's all you get. That's it. There's nothing more than that, than the hollow applause from people who don't know you and really don't care. So we get so addicted to the applause and approval of other people because of our vainglory that it's this terrible cycle that continues, but it's not real validation. It's not true validation. It's like us being confident or happy with getting paid in Monopoly money. It's just not real. It doesn't work. In other words, or the question probably is there something else than Jesus? Is there another reward that would give us more than just the empty applause of other people? And yes, there is. And that's what leads us to verse 3 and 4. This is option 2, giving to the needy. The first one is to be a hypocrite. The other one is, but when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. This idea of but says, yes, there is another option here. When you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. It's an easy metaphor. There's not a whole lot there, but let me explain it to you about not letting your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Jesus is pointing out here that self-deception is also a part of the human experience. What he is saying is we're not like the hypocrites who tell everybody else about it. That is charity gone sideways. But another way that charity or generosity can go sideways is when we start to tap ourselves on the shoulder for giving it. Now, there's a danger in being a hypocrite, but there's also a danger in self-congratulations about this. When this happens, that something that is altruistic or altruism, the idea that we can be generous towards other when we are self-congratulatory, altruism actually turns into egotism. And Jesus is saying, watch that you don't fake others out, but watch that you also don't fake yourself out here, that you kind of walk around with this pride saying, oh man, I did it. Look, I wish other people were like me. That's what Jesus is saying here. Do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be done in secret. And the secret here is just in contrast. Think of the trumpet, right? All the trumpets going on, looking at me, I'm such a good giver. Jesus says, no. Unlike the hypocrite, do your giving in secret so nobody has to know about it. It's the quiet, settled, at home in God's love, not trying to prove yourself to others. Then he says, then your Father who sees what is done in secret, here's again this idea of reward. He will reward you. Interesting language. That the Father who sees, in other words, we can't keep any secrets, both in a negative sense. If we do our righteousness with a bad motive, he sees. But in the same way, when we do it in secret, he also sees that posture as well. And he will reward you. What are the rewards, right? We like it. We're reward-based people. What is the reward? Well, oftentimes, especially in this topic about giving, we kind of think it's like, well, man, I'll give and then I'm going to receive, right? So it's like, you know, Lord, you saw, right? Now just, right? I gave some money, now would you give some money? That's unfortunately not what Jesus is talking about here. He's not talking about rewards financially. No. What are the rewards? Well, think about it. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Unlike the hypocrites who get paid in Monopoly money, this is a real reward. And what is it? Let me illustrate it this way. I'm a dad, 3 young kids, and inevitably, almost daily, it's such a great thing. I'll hear from my kids, Daddy, watch! Daddy, watch! So I'll go to Micah, and he's built this cool car ramp, or he's playing in the dirt. Daddy, watch what I've done! And then my older daughter will say, Daddy, watch! Look at what I drew! Look at my painting! Look at my picture! And I'll, Hannah, that's amazing! And my little girl will say, Daddy, look at me twirl! And she'll twirl around, and it's just beautiful. What are they looking for? All of these moments, all of these commands, Daddy, watch, what is that? It's an invitation to relationship. Daddy, watch. Daddy, get down with me in the dirt. Daddy, come over to the table. Daddy, come and look. It's an invitation to relationship. Why? So that they would get validation from their Father. Approval, love, recognition from their Father. When we give in secret, what Jesus is saying is that we say, Daddy, watch. What? I know that you see my heart. I know that you see that I have a generous heart. And Daddy, would you watch as I give in secret with pure motivation to see needs met? Absolutely. But that you would be proud of my righteousness, my right action, whole body behavior, hands and heart and feet and mind and arms and whatever that is. That this is an invitation to relationship. And the reward that we get is affirmation, validation from the Father. See, there is a deep part of you and I that longs for validation and longs for approval. And since the fall in Genesis 3, we have been walking around unsettled and insecure. And like I said, we walk around like a politician does, looking for our approval ratings from other people. But with God, we don't have to play that game. That the Father is for us and he loves us. There's a poet, songwriter. Her name is Mary Carr. She's not a Christian. This is not a Christian work that I'm presenting to you. But she wrote memoirs of her life. It's in a memoir called Cherry. And in this work, she tells the story. She tells the story of her when she was 14 years old, and she was going through a lot of issues personally, like a lot of teenagers do, and there was loneliness and depression, and her parents left for the day, and in one of these really, really dark states, Mary decided that it would be time to end her life, and so she swallowed a whole bunch of pills, tragically wanting to end her own life. This attempt was not successful, and the outcome was that she simply just got really, really, really sick, really sick. So her parents came back and saw Mary, who was really, really sick, and they didn't know, they didn't make the connection to where she was at. They just thought it was food poisoning. So they did whatever they could to help her out, and Mary, at the end of the day, she says, "I'm going to bed," and her dad says, Mary, what can I do to give you something to eat?" And she said, "The only thing that I'm interested in eating are plums. But they're out of season, so I can't have them." And then Mary went to bed. Well, her father, knowing her desire for plums, living in East Texas, he drove through the night to Alabama where he could get some plums. He drove all the way back to East Texas. And Mary recounts her dad waking her up in her bedroom the next morning with a bushel of plums. In her memoir, Cherry, this is what Carr says. "But it's when you sink your teeth into the plum that you make a promise. The skin is still warm from riding in the sun in Daddy's truck, and the nectar runs down your chin, and you snap out of it or are snapped out of it. Never again will you lay a hand against yourself, not so long as there are plums to eat and somebody, anybody who gives enough to haul them to you." You see what she's saying? That the love of her father to go to Alabama to bring it spoke to her about love and sacrifice. And she snapped out of where she was at. She goes on, "That's how you acquire the resolution for survival that the coming years are about to demand." Listen to what she says. "You don't earn it. It's given. You don't earn this type of love. It's given by a father, a good father." Man, and how many of us need to hear this language right now? Because we all live with the sense that we're not enough. That we all walk around with the sense of not enoughness, trying to live with vain glory, trying to feed our soul with something that will not satisfy. And here, Carr's not enoughness was remedied by her father's love. And so it is with the gospel. So it is with the cosmic story of Father, Son, and Spirit working together for your redemption. That the Father's love can solve your social media addiction where you're just looking at everybody else, giving up pieces of yourself for the approval of others. This is the type of love that can fill the father wound like Ray Romano has, or you have. You grew up with a father who did not approve, who did not bring dignity, who did not come at your level and love you. And this is the love that you're looking for. This love will help all of us. For those of us who've made mistakes and lies in the past to impress others, to counteract some of the lies that we're believing about our worth and presenting our false self to everybody. That the Father's love allows us to come out of hiding about who we are, about our worth, about our physical appearance. The Father's love is the remedy to the lies that you are believing. And so what vainglory, the lie that we believe when we live with our false self because of vainglory, is that we look at others and think, how you see me is how I see me. So if you think well of me, then I'm okay. That's the lie. That's a destructive lie that we can believe. But the gospel comes and says, no. How you see me is not how I see me. Listen, how God sees me, how the Father sees me is how I see me. And that is the invitation. And there's lots of maybe good resources about self-help and positive thinking and self-image and all that sort of stuff. And sure, but what you need is to hear the affection of the Father over you, saying, I love you. I love you, not because of what you've done, but because of who you are. I see everything and I still love you and I still pursue you. So that leads us to communion. It leads us to this great moment, to the table, where we are reminded again, and I've been rocked this week by this whole text in Ephesians 1. Listen to what Paul says in Ephesians, in love. This is talking about the Father. Paul's talking about the Father. In love, he predestined us for adoption to sonship through Jesus Christ in accordance with his pleasure. This is talking about the Father. It is because of the Father's love and his pleasure towards you that the whole story of Jesus came to be. It's because of love. Think about adoption. Adoption happens because of benevolent nature of the family adopting the child. It has nothing to do with the child as far as what they can bring to the table. It has everything to do with the love of the Father welcoming them into their home. What a story. He predestined us for adoption to sonship through Jesus Christ in accordance with his pleasure and his will. Think about the gospel. Think about Jesus. That through Jesus, we are, because of the Father, through Jesus, we are predestined, that he chooses us because of his love, that the spiritual fracture in our lives, looking for everybody else horizontally to fill the void in our soul when that is available in Jesus. That Jesus does not live for the approval of others as he goes to the cross, as he is betrayed and as he is mocked and as he is belittled. He does not live for the recognition of others, but rather for the recognition of the Father whose will sent him to the cross. He doesn't seek their approval, but the Father's. The whole plan of salvation is because Jesus said yes to the approval of the Father when everybody else disapproved of him, so that because of that Jesus was forsaken on the cross, we can be accepted. That all of the lies and all of the false self and all of the hypocritical living is redeemed because of Jesus. And this is what we think about here at the table. So in 1 Corinthians 11, these words of institution, let me lead you through them. 1 Corinthians 11, the same one who wrote Ephesians writes Corinthians, and he says, for I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, he took bread, simple bread. When he had given thanks, he broke it, and he said, this is my body. This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And in the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup is a new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. That the approval of the Father, seen in the death and resurrection of Jesus, offers, welcomes, beckons us to the table to feel the love and the embrace of God. So may you find him through these elements wherever you are, and may you be reminded that you are so loved today. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for trusting us. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.